Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria, and I want to give a shout out to those amazing listeners who are helping to support the podcast by going to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledging just a little bit to help keep us 100% free to download. I want to start by thanking Greg Rogers and Ron Noblock. Thank you so much for your incredibly generous donations. I will send you your goodies in the mail very soon. Just as soon as the month is over, you will get those. I also want to thank Rob Barcy, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell for your generous donations. And meanwhile, over there on PayPal, I want to thank Megan Prout. You guys are amazing. If you're interested in supporting the show, you can head to carasantamaria.com and you'll see some links there on the site, or you can go straight to patreon.com/talknerdy. All right, guys, I am really excited about this week's podcast episode. I had a chance to sit down with just an incredibly intelligent dude. We have a great chat. Some of it I get a little bit lost on. You might too, but you know what? You're going to learn something too, and just fabulous. He's an entrepreneur, and he's also a graduate student at Caltech who is studying quantum information theory. Here he is, Sean McGuire. Sean, welcome to Talk Nerdy.
Thanks for having me here, Kara.
I am so excited. I've shown you around my fabulous apartment. Fabulous. I find it fabulous because it's filled with dinosaurs.
There are lots of dinosaurs, and then there's also Killer.
Killer is the most fabulous part of the apartment. I think some of my listeners listen to the podcast solely so that they can hear me either talk about Killer or so that they can hear like a cute little whimper or bark in the background. He's hiding in the corner right now.
There will probably be a guest appearance later.
I think so. We'll try and work that in. So I'm super excited to have you on the show. I don't know you that well, and I get excited about episodes that I get to do with people who are friends or who are friends of friends but are also kind of professional colleagues but who I don't know that well because I get to know you on air along with everybody else. So we're just going to throw you to the wolves today.
Should be interesting.
Cool. So, I mean, I know you threw some friends in the Nerd Brigade, and you are a Caltech graduate student as of right now.
Yeah. I've been in graduate school for 8 years.
8 years.
I've done 2 leaves of absence.
And you've also gotten a few master's degrees along the way, right?
Yeah. Yes. Gotten 3 master's degrees.
3 master's degrees along the way, ultimately working towards a PhD, but also have some amazing kind of roads that you could be following.
Yeah. I'd like to say that I have a nose for opportunities and I'm good at identifying them, and when something comes up, I go for it for a couple of years.
I think that's important because you know what? I talk a lot. I give talks about, you know, women in STEM and minorities in STEM and about recruitment rates amongst undergrads and graduates and even faculty in different areas. Specifically, I would say engineering and math are really struggling for women. And sometimes I will meet with professors, even young professors, who have this hardcore kind of mentality of like, no matter what, we got to get them in school. We got to keep them in school. We got to make sure that they go all the way through and they become tenured professors because the numbers show that there aren't that many women doing that. But at the same time, it's like I 50-50 want to advocate for that because it's so fucking important. But I also want to advocate for like, hey, man, if something else comes up in your life that's a good opportunity, like go through that open door.
Yeah, I mean, some of these doors really open one time and there's this drive, especially in academia, to follow the linear path. You know, a lot of professors, they get a lot of credit when their students go and become famous professors. You know, it's a very high-risk thing to say, become an entrepreneur. That usually fails.
Yep.
And that's not the currency of academia. But to me, it's fun.
So you've taken 2 leaves of absence to go do a couple things that we'll talk about. And you're potentially going to take another one soon. Spoiler alert, Dr. Preskill.
I talked about this with him yesterday.
Okay, good, good, good. So how, for example, how is his counsel and how previously has it felt for you when you talk to your PIs, your major professors about that? Have they been really resistant or have they been pretty cool?
I've had the whole range.
Really?
One professor said that I couldn't work with him if I followed the opportunity I was presented with, and that was a pretty unique opportunity. That's when I got recruited to work on a DARPA project and ended up deploying to Afghanistan, and we can talk about that later. But basically, he told me, no, you need to just, if you want to work with me, mathematics all the time. So
you had to actually leave.
So I actually had to leave.
There was a catch-22 there.
Yeah. And I had, there was a professor who I was friends with and who was an ally. And so I last second, switched. He became on paper my advisor, kind of covered for me while I was gone, and then helped me come back to Caltech.
That's great, because otherwise you may not have been able to literally come back to the university that was home to you.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And that's important. You know, I dropped out of my PhD program, and I was lucky enough to have a very good professor. It was the first time, maybe not the first time in my life, because in undergrad I did once, but it was the first time as a graduate student that I had a PI that was female. And she was just incredibly understanding, and I talked to her about all of the different, you know, things that were swirling around in my head. And ultimately, as much as she was like, I don't want you to leave, she was also like, I don't want you to be in my lab if you fucking don't want to be here. Like, I want you to be happy and make the decisions that are right for you. And now, in hindsight, it's very easy for me to say, like, yes, I totally made that decision and it was the right decision. But I get these emails all the time. I get Facebook messages, I get Twitter messages from people who are like, I don't know what to do. You know, I feel like I'm supposed to stay the course.
Yeah, they're called sunk costs in economics, and we struggle with them as humans.
And so what does that refer to?
That, you know, you've put in a bunch of time for something, or you spend a bunch of money on something. And after you've done that, like, it changes the way you evaluate what you should do next compared to if you hadn't already invested any time or money and you're just presented with the same exact, you know, situation.
It's like in poker when you're pot committed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you've already played 3 betting rounds. There's only 1 or 2 left and you've put so much money in that it's like,
you're attached
to it. Is it worth the risk?
It.
Yeah, yeah, and I've had friends, you know what? And the truth is you've got to measure it, because it's like, how close are you to finishing the PhD? How invested in the thesis project are you? Because I've definitely had friends who in the 11th hour were like, fuck this, I'm leaving. And you're like, no, no, you've done all the work. Like, it's not worth it at this point. And then you have other people like myself. I was only a year into my PhD. I'd finished a master's, but I was only a year into my PhD. And it was like, I had a long road ahead of me, and that was not the road that was going to make me happy. So are you kind of in that place right now?
I'm pretty close to finishing. I think my PhD advisor may disagree, but I gave 2 invited talks 2 months ago.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good sign, but I haven't published papers about my research.
About this specific research,
this research.
So I want to talk, actually, before we get into some of those other cool, you know, opportunities, some of them are a bit shrouded in secrecy, so we'll see what we can say and what we can't, because you have, you've had jobs with, weird security clearances and shit like that, which is awesome, like an agent, a double agent. You're not really,
no
he's
comment.
Not really a double agent. but before we talk about that, let's talk about the research that you do, because it's fascinating to me, and also I do not understand it at all. And this is something that on the podcast, I try really hard. You know, I've had a string theorist on, really kind of walk me through classical Newtonian physics up into quantum mechanics, up into this crazy world of string theory, and kind of walking me through a lot of this stuff. We're both friends with Sean Carroll. Sean Carroll explains the Higgs field and all these quantum fields. And I kind of feel like I sort of get some of that stuff, but quantum information, it's like a weird semi-theoretical, semi-applied field, which is kind of confusing to me.
Perfect. I am really excited to talk about this.
Good.
I really enjoy trying to explain difficult things.
Perfect.
And I'm not given the opportunity to try enough.
Okay, good. Well, so before we even jump into it, I will recommend anybody listening, if you aren't listening to Talk Nerdy in order, to go back and listen to Mark Jackson's episode, because we spent probably the first 45 minutes building up to string theory, and only in the last chunk of the episode did we talk about string theory. So it has a very good foundation for kind of the state of modern physics and the physics that you learn in school and the physics that you learn in grad school, and kind of, you know, the idea of how classical physics and quantum mechanics, what's missing and why they can't join. And so I think that that is a good primer. And that way, maybe we don't have to talk about, you know, like what an electron cloud is, but we can talk more specifically about what the fuck is quantum information? Like, what does that even mean?
Yeah, well, I'll motivate it in a very different way. And then I'll say that where I'm going is different than probably 95% of the people that do quantum information think about either like how you build something called a quantum computer or what you do with it.
Yeah, we hear about quantum computers all the time. That's like a buzzword in you know, like pop science magazine or something.
So I guess we can try to get there a little bit.
Also, Killer is like scratching in the corner like a cat. Like he's trying to dig a hole through the carpet. It's now he's just looking at me like he did something wrong. So if that's what you hear, that's what you hear. Get over it. All right, cool. Here we go.
All right, Killer. I think Killer's probably listening to this too. He's going to come in and give us all the answers we need.
Perfect.
So I'm in like the 5% small minority of quantum information that thinks about black holes and kind of a paradox that Stephen Hawking introduced in 1975. And so we'll probably get there a little bit. And then probably 95% of the people think about either how to build a quantum computer or what you would do with it, or kind of the, so what is quantum information? First, you need to think about what is like classical information theory. And this really started at the turn of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, people started thinking about building computers, you know, what people use today and like what you just had a little disk problem with.
Yeah.
but then the other side of information theory is like, say you're going to try to transmit information across what they call a channel. So you're sending Morse code, you know, or you're, you know, using radio waves to send.
Or you're making a telephone call.
Right. Or you're making a telephone call. And if there's some noise in the channel, like maybe you're trying to send zeros and ones, and sometimes one of the zeros or ones gets flipped to the opposite. Now you need some error correction in order to be able to squeeze as much information as possible into this channel.
Okay.
So this is work that people started doing, you know, 1900 to 1950, made a lot of progress thinking about sending information across channels or building computers. And now there's this quantum version of it. We're kind of going back over these things where the fundamental like building blocks are different. Instead of just zeros or ones, you know, people hear about superpositions and entanglement and all this. And with these new quantum building blocks, like the way that you would try to send information across a channel is different. The way the codes look is different. How much information you can squeeze into a channel is different. Entanglement is a very powerful resource, is something that we like to say. And so that's one thing, is thinking about how you'd send information, say, like, across a fiber optic network.
So but in that context, and correct me if I'm wrong here, when these kinds of technologies were being developed, computational technologies and communication technologies, the fundamental building block or the fundamental unit of information was relatively large in hindsight. And what you're talking about is individuals thinking about very, very small units and how they interact with each other.
So that's kind of a different thing that's going on in parallel. So
it is. Okay. Because when I think of quantum, like just to back up a little bit, when I think of the quantum world, I think of the world that's smaller than the atom. It's the tiny things. And once you get down to that level, shit gets weird.
Yeah. So this is, I'll be honest, this is kind of a common misconception.
Is it? Okay, good.
This is, so everyone, sidebar, but important sidebar, what is quantum?
Yeah.
You know, quantum can happen on any scale. So you can have like macroscopic quantum phenomena.
You can. This worries me. You saying this worries me. So let's couch it after you explain that, because this is when I hear like the woo-woo crazies trying to take quantum mechanics and apply it to like thought patterns and like, you know, like what the bleep do we know, and the Deepak Chopras of the world, like trying to talk about quantum mechanics in a non-applied way, or a way that probably is a little bit not prudent to apply it. So that's, I think, a fear. But when you say that it can happen at the macro level, like, what do you mean?
Yeah, so lots of examples.
Okay.
So one would be, like, say you cool helium-3 down to some low temperature.
Okay.
Then even like a large amount of helium-3, if it's cold enough, then it's going to behave quantumly. Like it's quantum mechanics that's going to describe what's going to happen to the fluid.
So as we're approaching like zero Kelvin, things start to act fucked up too.
Yeah. So these things will become like a superfluid, for example, gotcha. Where it's going to flow without any resistance. Or if any of you have seen those videos of like magnets that float and get like phase locked, and there's this video on YouTube, they put magnets above a table and, you know, you push it and mm-hmm. it will spin around forever. And it's levitating. And this is due to something called the Meissner effect.
And that's superconductivity?
Exactly. Okay. Like there are kind of two types of superconductivity. And gotcha. One of them is what happens with like the magnetic flux lines always.
But that also requires like extreme cold, no?
Yeah, exactly. But so that's the point, is that okay. like quantum happens in extremes.
Gotcha. But so it's not just about being just small.
Right. Extremely cold or extremely small.
Or extremely fast. Hopefully.
So that's maybe. Where relativity kicks in.
Yeah.
And what I study is what happens when you're quantum and, you know, really fast. So like when gotcha. General relativity meets quantum mechanics.
So quantum mechanics doesn't really apply there. Relativity applies there. And quantum mechanics and relativity don't actually play that nice together.
Yeah. And so this is what people say. And this is like exactly the field I'm in. And basically, kind of to jump ahead, mm-hmm. Stephen Hawking had a really amazing run from like 1965 to end of the 1970s. And in 1975... he introduced something called the information paradox.
Okay.
And he basically asked the question, the hand-wavy thing is if you throw an encyclopedia into a black hole, but like the more technical things, if you throw a pure quantum state. So this means a quantum state that's not entangled with anything else. So like you prepare an encyclopedia and you prepare it kind of in isolation from its environment. So it starts off not entangled with the environment. Okay. So you throw that encyclopedia inside the black hole. Quantum mechanics, kind of like in the axioms of quantum mechanics, one of the axioms is it's called unitary evolution. And what this means in the black hole context is you throw an encyclopedia in, and because Hawking had previously shown that black holes evaporate eventually, so that eventually it'll disappear, when it's left behind, that encyclopedia should the information, like basically the pure state, should still exist in the future. And if you kind of had a really amazing mastery of physics, you'd be able to reverse, kind of do some archaeology and reverse engineer all the stuff that came out of the black hole and find that encyclopedia and put it back together again.
Okay, so this is getting interestingly intermixed with other conversations that I've had that I'm not sure what relates and what doesn't, because this is probably a common experience for all of my listeners. Like I'm thinking, okay, I was going to say like 99%. Like maybe some of you listening are quantum physicists and you know this and you're studying this actively, but I mean, black hole physics is fucking crazy, right? And so
it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. So when you think of black hole physics, you think of a lot of different fields. So to back up, you mentioned most people who study quantum information are looking at building a quantum computer, or they're looking at improving the way or fixing the way that information...
Like quantum, yeah, communications channels.
Yes.
And we can talk about that later if you're interested.
But then 25%, let's say, are actually cosmologists. They're interested in the same kinds of things that other what we think of as traditional cosmologists are interested in, but they're looking at it from this quantum information perspective.
Yeah, and in particular thinking about black holes. So
specifically black holes is very important.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a saying that's going around right now, so people would say that the harmonic oscillators were the physics laboratory of the 20th century. You know, you study, when you learn quantum mechanics or even classical mechanics, you look at like, oh, I have three balls and they're tethered together and try to predict what's going to happen.
Okay.
Kind of our laboratory for theorists in the 21st century are black holes. And so
you don't actually have a black hole in your lap.
No, exactly. Only in my head.
See, this is the interesting thing about a physics quote-unquote laboratory when we're talking about theoretical physics, too, because you, of course, when you're a researcher, you go to work and you go to what we call a laboratory, but it's not full of equipment per se. It's full of, like, whiteboards and desks, right?
I usually work in a coffee shop. I have another sidebar. I have peculiar work habits. Some of you have probably seen me around. I'm the guy who always stands in coffee shops. I like fall asleep if I sit down. So I always find a coffee shop that has a tall table and kind of camp out for hours. It's my standing desk.
And what you're doing is you're working out. I mean, I know to like somebody who doesn't understand and looks over your shoulder, you're like a beautiful mind. You're like John Nash? No, it wasn't John.
Yeah,
was it John Nash? Yeah, so you're just like scribbling crazy equations. In your head, of course, all of those equations represent real science and math.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some pictures, too.
There's pictures, too.
There are even some pictures sometime.
So you're thinking about a black hole. And I want to try and understand the different ways that people think about black holes. So you are thinking about a black hole in this field that's quantum information theory. There are some people that think about black holes and they study classical kind of quantum mechanics. There are other people that study black holes and they are looking at, I don't know, general relativity.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll jump in. I'm enjoying this. This is fun. So yeah, black holes were originally theorized maybe in like the 1930s or late 1920s, they came up with the solution of Einstein's equations. And for a long time, people were trying to figure out how you can detect them experimentally.
So they really were the way that we think about dark matter now. Like the equations said that they existed, but we didn't really have a lot of evidence as to their existence yet.
Yeah, actually, this is one of the rare examples where theory really just beat experiments.
Yeah.
So Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking they came up with some singularity theorems and showed theoretically that black holes really had to exist in the early 60s. And then just a couple of years later, people kind of had the first experimental evidence, first convincing evidence that black holes actually exist.
And that sort of happened recently with the Higgs field too. Like there was this idea that, yeah, we're pretty sure the Higgs field, everybody just kind of accepted, of course the Higgs fields exist, but not until they could really do those experiments at CERN could they get evidence for it.
Yeah, exactly. And then I would say a lot of the time it's the other way around where experimentalists find something really cool that no one can explain. Yeah. And then we scratch our heads for like 10 to 100 years. And
They go, oh, there's this signature in the dark sky. I'm looking at, you know, my pictures of the sky and this one star seems to be dancing and I don't know why. And then they're able to come up with something to explain why.
Yeah, like just two examples. Or one was, it's called the photoelectric effect, and explaining this is what Einstein won his Nobel Prize for, and that's like you shine a flashlight on a piece of metal and current starts to flow. And it's basically because photons, that's where we learned that they have some particle-like behavior. And they're basically like bumping electrons, and then they start moving and create current.
And for those who don't know, a photon is like, I guess it's the tiniest packet of light. The tiniest information unit of light.
Yeah. So actually defining a photon is a hard thing. And it's, you know, you need to talk about quantum mechanics. But yeah, that's right. They're kind of the...
It's how we measure light. Light is measured in photons. They're the little subcomponents of light that have an effect on things.
Yeah, that's right.
And
kind of famously, they behave both like particles and like waves, depending on the context.
Gotcha.
And that's why the photoelectric effect was so important. It was one of like three experiments in the early 1900s that kind of people couldn't explain. And trying to explain them is what led to quantum mechanics. Mm. Like another example that most people probably haven't heard of, but there's some really beautiful stuff from the early 1980s, these experiments called quantum Hall experiments. And, you know, two Nobel Prizes went for this in the 80s and the 90s. And this led to like another very modern field in physics, which people should read about if you want to see like what's cutting edge. And this is called like topological states, topological phases of matter. It's another example where experiment kind of surprised everyone and then took 20 to 30 years to kind of explain it.
Interesting. So topological states, these are like the, this is like hipster physics. This is like what all the cool kids know about. They're the new thing.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to drop on people.
But then we think back to early quantum mechanics, and Einstein was like the OG. Like, this is where it all came from.
Yeah. So Einstein was absolutely the OG for special relativity and general relativity. Mm-hmm. He kind of is incredibly impressive. Came up with this stuff basically alone.
Yeah.
Quantum mechanics doesn't really have one OG.
Gotcha.
There are maybe 5 to 20 really important kind of founding players.
So it was kind of the state of the time in physics was that Einstein was explaining a lot of things, but then certain things were like, okay, in explaining this, there needs to be another explanation for this other thing that follows. And so his research fed into a lot of what we now know of as quantum research, but a lot of other people were having to pick up that baton.
Yeah, so like with the beginning of quantum mechanics, there were, I haven't thought about this in like a decade, but I think there were 3 experiments mm-hmm. that were all kind of, or one of them was a thought experiment, but that were unexplained. Mm-hmm. by the current physics, and explaining those 3 things kind of led people to this theory of quantum mechanics.
It was 3?
Yeah, okay. So one was this photoelectric effect, where before that, you know, it's very obvious that to make light have a wave-like behavior, you know, you have like 2 slits,
yeah.
and you shine light through there, and you get these interference patterns, and that's like the wave-like behavior. But then the photoelectric effect, shining light on a piece of metal and having current flow, that took like a particle-like interpretation. So this was one clue, was that light is both a wave and a particle. Another experiment was called it's called the black body spectrum. Mm-hmm. And this is basically you take a hot object and let it cool down.
Mm-hmm.
And when you try to explain the amount of like energy that is radiated, If you allow like all possible frequencies of light to be emitted, then you try to do the calculation, you get infinity, that like infinite energy should be released from this plate, but that doesn't seem right.
Uh-huh.
And what people had to realize, I think it was Planck, that if you only allow, call it energy, to be emitted in like certain discrete intervals, these multiples of this number h bar, and so then you do a sum instead of an integral, then you get a finite quantity, and that actually is the right answer. It actually matches the experiments there.
What does that tell us?
It tells us that, so instead of doing like allowing any possible energy, the values of like the energy of photons can only be in these discrete multiples of h bar. Think that they're kind of these discrete packets.
So it tells us that there's a certain amount of basically cutting down. There's only a certain amount of cutting something down that you can do before the subunits are no longer meaningful.
Yeah.
Kind of like we think of historically, there's some comedian or maybe somebody on a podcast once. I feel bad. I'm not giving anybody credit for this, but it was like the funniest thing I fucking heard one time. I think it was a comedian talking about how much we know now versus what we used to know, that like you can imagine an anatomy class from like the 1400s and your professor being like, if you cut a frog in half, all you have is 2 frogs. And if you cut that in half, you know, it's like the more that you dig deep, it's just frog through and through, you know. But now we know that there's like organ systems. And then when you go through the organ systems and there's like subcomponents called cells, and inside of the cells, there's all these different like parts of cell. And it's the same thing. Basically, physics is taking that concept and going down to the true fundamental, which is the...
Trying to.
Yes, it's the elements and then the atoms and then the subatomic particles that make up the frog.
Yep.
And so we know that instead of talking about frog, now we're talking about light. We know that light behaves both as a wave and a particle because we've seen different experimental evidence for it. And these 2 types of evidence you said is that, one, if you shine a light on metal, it will electrify it to some extent. And 2, you can only put light into a system in some sort of discrete amount.
Yeah, like the frequency of the mm-hmm. photons can only come in these discrete like allowed values. It can't take any possible value.
Gotcha.
And those allowed values are multiples of some number, some constant called Planck's constant. And so those were two of the clues, and I can't think of the third experiment off the top of my head. It's kind of embarrassing.
This wasn't like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle or anything like that. These are what led to that. Okay. Yeah. So basically there were these thought experiments. There were these problems that physicists had historically been always scratching their heads about, and they go, Newtonian physics doesn't solve it. Relativity doesn't solve it. Special relativity doesn't solve it. How the fuck are we going to solve it?
Exactly.
Okay.
So.
Okay. I'm up to speed.
No, you're so.
And from a philosophical standpoint, I'm up to speed. I don't understand any of the math.
Yeah.
I don't understand any of the language behind it.
And you don't need to. The point I'm trying to make is that there's another motto in physics, which is progress through paradox.
Okay.
And that comes from like pretty much every revolution in physics came from there was a paradox and people were just confused, super confused about. And so in 1900, people were super confused about the photoelectric effect and this black body experiment and experiment number three that I'm embarrassed because I can't remember.
You're going to get some tweets after this.
And so because of those three things, like it led to a reformulation, kind of a refinement of classical physics. And that's called quantum mechanics.
So when you say that this is a refinement of classical physics, like quantum mechanics is basic physics. Like when we think of what kids, like young kids, as they go into physics, if it's done the right way, they're going to be taught tenets of quantum mechanics, even if they don't call it quantum mechanics. That's how they're learning physics now.
Yes. Well,
or that's how smart they should
kids
be learning.
That's exactly how they should be. Yeah. And some kids are. It's kind of scary. Like, I don't know if you were at the Natural History Museum for the Nurburgring's first Friday, but there.
Oh yeah.
There were these two kids who.
Oh,
were
they were my favorite. So yeah, I think I might have mentioned this to you guys just to go off on a tangent. The Nurburgring, as you know, I've interviewed them all now on the podcast, and they're amazing, and they're my good friends. We volunteer once a month at the Los Angeles Natural History Museum, Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County, I think is what it's actually called, and we do this little science salon, and we talk about nerdy things. And this last time there are these two children that were like 9 and they were like geniuses and also adorable.
They knew quantum mechanics.
And I want to be friends with them.
Yeah, they were pretty popular.
They're kind of my heroes. anyway.
Well, yeah, so to kind of wrap up that thread, or at least for now, so we were talking about these experiments that were unexplained in 1900 and that led to a refinement of classical physics called quantum mechanics. And yeah, that kind of just completely usurped classical physics. So you get that as a limit, you know, when you go to hot big things are going to be classical, and you recover, you know, if you run through the quantum equations, you get the same prediction as classical physics, but you get this extra stuff. It also makes the right prediction about what happens when things are either really small or really cold.
Gotcha. When you say classical, you mean Newtonian?
Yeah, Newtonian. Okay. Sorry.
Right. No. Just want to make sure, because I think that that's what we're used to thinking about.
And then now I've got to give my plug. So part of why I went through this, this progress through paradox example is we're in a really exciting point in theoretical physics right now. And so Stephen Hawking in 1975 proposed something called the information paradox. And that's what essentially led to people thinking about string theory. Mm. Well, there were two things that led to that, but like that was one direction and it led to a deep idea called holography, which, you know, we don't need to talk about. But
I think I haven't had Brian Greene on the podcast, but I've definitely interviewed Brian Greene and he's a big proponent.
So all these things came from like trying to understand the information paradox, but then only in 2012, just a couple of years ago, some physicists from Santa Barbara sharpened this paradox. They kind of showed that physics, so when Hawking kind of did his work, you could push the paradox aside if you let bad things happen just at one point in space-time, only one little point, you know, the center of the black hole, the singularity. But then in 2012, these physicists showed that actually the paradox is all the way at the event horizon of the black hole. So that can be, you know, for a big black hole, that can be, you know, thousands of kilometers from the center. And so
historically, you're saying that this paradox, this thing where we couldn't quite reconcile in physics, historically everybody said, oh, that only applies in the event, or I'm sorry, in the singularity, in the very center of the black hole, fuck it, we'll just do our research everywhere else.
Pretty much.
And that's just the ooey gooey weird part of the black hole that nobody fully understands. And then other researchers were like, no, but that's the interesting part. I want to focus on that part. And then along comes this this paper in 2012 that said,
the firewall paradox.
Gotcha. That said, and, hey guys, no, look closer, because this paradox is basically the entire fucking black hole.
Exactly. And so it's much harder to sweep, you know, something the size of a star.
Yeah. Under the rug.
Yeah, under the rug.
When we talk about this paradox, what is it? What are the two things that aren't reconciling?
Well, so this is when people say that general relativity and quantum mechanics don't play nice, they're talking about Stephen Hawking's information paradox. And
that has to do with gravity, right?
Yeah. So it's that, like, both, you can't have both, like, gravity, general relativity, and quantum mechanics, like, they can't both be exactly right in their current formulation. At least one of them needs to be modified on some level.
Gotcha. So if you were to measure the gravity of like the Earth pulling on the moon in both quantum mechanics and relativity, you'd come to kind of the same conclusions. But the minute that you start looking at the gravity inside of a black hole, somebody's wrong because they're not reconciling.
Yeah, exactly. And gotcha. And so basically, if you throw an encyclopedia into a black hole, someone who believes in quantum mechanics would say that 60 billion years into the future after the black hole has evaporated, you're going to be able to look at all the junk that's left behind, and a really good archaeologist will be able to put back together that exact encyclopedia. And someone that believes in general relativity would say, nope, the information in that encyclopedia, like, completely gone. No one's ever going to be able to know. Future super archaeologists can put this back together.
But that's not really a dominant mindset anymore, right? Most people have moved into quantum mechanics, and so now they're trying to say, how do we reconcile it back with what we know about special relativity?
Well,
am I wrong? Or is that those are the hot scientists who are writing the popular science books?
Well, I think that was maybe correct until 2012. And then now with this new, like, this sharpening of the paradox, which we're calling the firewall paradox, everyone's really confused.
I think everyone being really confused is a good point to take a break, to thank our sponsor of this week's episode, and then come back and try and sort out some of that confusion. We'll be right back with Sean McGuire. Today's episode of Talk Nerdy is brought to you by Squarespace. Simple, powerful, and beautiful. I remember before Squarespace, I didn't even have a website, actually. I don't think I wanted to build one because I was, you know, I had friends who wrote blogs and they were all on different websites that, you know, were supposed to help you put something together. Some of them actually before that were doing their websites with HTML. And I was just like, guys, I don't have time to learn how to program a website. And I definitely don't love the way that some of yours are turning out. But with Squarespace, gosh, like, all of those issues are just gone. I first sat down with Squarespace probably well over a year ago now, and I just started designing. And before I knew it, I had a fully functional web space that I had built all by myself, and it's absolutely gorgeous. And I can update it all on my own, which is another great thing. Sometimes you pay somebody to put together a website for you, but then you have to send them information every time you want something updated. Screw that. Those days are over with Squarespace. And guys, if you do have any problems, if you do run into any trouble while you're trying to put your website together, they will help you out. They've got 24/7 support via live chat and email. So you just, like, drop them a line. They'll get back to you right away. I've used it before in the middle of the night, which is when I work, and they were really responsive. And it's only $8 a month. I mean, it can't get any less expensive than that, especially if you are trying to support a new business. You get a free domain name, too, if you buy Squarespace for the year. Probably one of my favorite parts about Squarespace is that it's got a responsive design. So you're going to design your website on your laptop, but then if you pick up an iPad or an iPhone or another device, it will change all of the dimensions and it'll look really gorgeous no matter what device you're looking at it on. And lastly, if you have a site and you want to sell your wares, there's commerce. It's built right in. Every single website comes with a free online store. So I don't know what you're waiting for. You guys can start a trial with no credit card required, and you can start building your website today. And then when you decide that you want to sign up for Squarespace, make sure that you use the offer code NERDY, because you'll get 10% off and you'll be showing your support for the show. So once again, guys, use that offer code NERDY. You'll get 10% off and you will be helping to support the podcast. I want to thank you guys for being such amazing fans and listeners, and I want to thank Squarespace for their support of Talk Nerdy. Squarespace, build it beautiful. All right, we are back with Sean McGuire, and we're talking about a paper that came out in 2012 that basically confused the fuck out of every physicist on the planet.
That's exactly right.
So that paper, it said that basically the paradox, this information paradox, this gravity doesn't seem to work at the singularity, the super, super center of the black hole that everybody kind of was like, yeah, but we'll just kind of ignore that and work around it. Now it applies to the entire black hole. Like the Event Horizon, I know this because I watched that movie, Event Horizon, where the spaceship went to hell. Do you guys remember that movie? No, but the definition of that is the point at which, the point of no return.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Okay. Like, even if you were shining a laser, you know, say you're like flying into a black hole and you're shining a laser, the event horizon is the point that no one's ever going to see the, you know, the gotcha. Light from your laser anymore.
And it actually is, like if you look at, you know, imagery, like a Hubble image or something like that, and you can actually physically see a black, it's the point where you can't see anything anymore. It's yeah. just the point where it goes black.
Yep.
Okay.
And they did a really good job in Interstellar of, you know, rendering these kind of beautiful.
Did they? I still haven't seen it. Beautiful. And I feel like there were like, sorry, random aside. I feel like there were really mixed reviews from my science friends, but also some scientists, kind of like the conversation that we had just last night, actually, at dinner, which, guys, you're totally eavesdropping now. I'm not including you at all. And your friend was like ranting about like snobby scientists being snobby about their science and how it's annoying. And I agree. I have some science friends who watch movies like that. And no matter how well they're done, they just take issue because that's not real science.
You can't have flouting, or you can't have, you know, ice clouds.
Yeah. Or like
floating.
There's no sound in space, guys, or whatever. But then I have other friends who are like, oh, it was fucking really well done, and they only fucked up a few things. Like, I'm pretty happy with it. I haven't seen Interstellar. Which camp are you in?
It's beautiful. Uh-huh. So the cinematography is gorgeous. The black hole physics and, like, general relativity stuff is great. The plot was good. They could have cut out, like, 30 minutes of the movie, and that would have made it a better movie, in my opinion. Like, there were parts that were slow.
Yeah.
And then the final physics scene was really, yeah, well, was really like speculative.
Gotcha.
So I don't have a problem with
but
people
that's pretty
making,
interesting.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with people like making a big leap. I feel like all but like one or two things that physicists know well, you know, they got it totally right.
That's
but
great.
Then,
so they obviously did their research.
They
like
had
they tried.
Kip Thorne. Really awesome Caltech physicist, Caltech shout out, who, you know, kind of wrote the first version of the movie. And
Kip Thorne does not like me.
Oh. Well,
it's kind of random, right? I'm about to do some horrible name dropping. I went to Kip Thorne's house a few St. Patrick's days ago for Stephen Hawking's birthday, and it was wonderful. And I met Stephen and had a great conversation with him. I mean, it's slow. It's hard to have a conversation with him. A lot of people don't realize, but when he goes and gives talks or when he does like media interviews, he works for months to script that stuff out because it's belaboring just to write a certain, like a single sentence. He does it with his cheek muscle. Like he has almost no motor ability. So I sat with him for almost an hour and I think it was 2.5 sentences that he was able to say. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing and it was compelling and it was emotional for me. And I was a science writer at the time. I was working at the Huffington Post and I wrote a story that I thought was beautiful about him. But it wasn't about his physics. It was about his ALS. And Kip was not happy with that. And I find that I had some other physicists tell me, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson and some other people read it and were like, it's good. Don't worry about it. People can be sensitive about this. And I get it because I think that there are certain people in this world who are just such giants that you don't want them to be human. You know what
yep,
I mean?
Yep.
And Steven's human. I mean, he has an assistant who helps him eat. And it's like, it's hard to watch. Like, it's sad and it's touching. But that's also not a side of him that he wants publicized. But maybe, you know, after Theory of Everything, the sensitivity's gone down. You know, he's maybe a little more desensitized to it. And I always did wonder, was Kip really protecting Stephen? Like, did Stephen give a fuck? What did he think? Did he even read my paper? He probably didn't. But what would he have thought? Or maybe it was just Kip being very protective of his best friend.
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah. I would guess the latter, but it's hard to speculate.
But, and of course, Kip Thorne is a brilliant physicist, too, and a very kind man. And he welcomed me into his home. And, you know, he shared photos with me, and he did some great stuff. He didn't know the direction my story was going, and I don't think he was happy with it. But at the same time, you know, I think we made nice, and we sent some emails back and forth. And finally, you know, I offered to interview him, and I offered to hear a wonderful story from him about it. And I think ultimately he was like, no, it's fine. But sorry, random aside. But yeah, Kip Thorne, I don't think he likes me very much. Shit.
Well, he writes amazing textbooks. So
there you go. Kip Thorne is like one of the preeminent physicists of our time. Like, of course, he's Stephen Hawking's best friend, like literally his best friend. And so Kip Thorne, you said...
Well, he wrote the first version of Interstellar, and...
He wrote the entire first version?
Yeah, he wrote the first version.
I didn't know that.
I mean, I know he was working with other people while he did that. The way I understand it, originally Steven Spielberg was going to make the movie. Mm-hmm. They had kind of these high-power meetings where, like, John Preskill, one of my two PhD advisors, was part of that, and a bunch of, you know, famous physicists, and they would kind of brainstorm the aspects of the movie. I do think that, Steven Spielberg dropped out, mm-hmm. and Chris Nolan picked it up. And
do you think that's because he didn't feel like he had enough creative? I mean, who knows?
I have no idea.
It is really hard. That's a weird world that I see a lot living in Hollywood, but being a science communicator, is this weird world of like science communicators wanting to see more science on TV, but then being really rigid and inflexible with how they want to see it portrayed. And we all want to see it portrayed correctly, but we also understand that a filmmaker needs to make a film that's compelling and interesting.
Yep.
And that doesn't always get, and maybe, who knows, but maybe Steven Spielberg was like, fuck this, I hate working with physicists.
Or like the opportunity of a lifetime came up to him.
Exactly,
you know,
that's true.
Because this was back in 2004
or
something.
His kid was getting married. It's like, you never know, exactly. You know. But so I wonder how Kip Thorne felt about Matthew McConaughey being cast.
Yeah. Well,
maybe they're like BFF now.
Probably.
Maybe they go out to dinner all the time.
Yeah, they're having their own science forays that we're not invited to.
God damn it. How do we get in on that?
Yeah, those are the A-list science forays.
We're like the D-list science foray over here. Anyway, sorry, random aside. Kip Thorne was involved on Interstellar. Why do we bring up Interstellar? Oh, because you said they made an Event Horizon beautiful.
Yeah, like, it's incredibly impressive. They've written academic papers about this. Like, this is something they're really proud of in the movie.
Gotcha, because it's hard to portray.
Yeah, I mean, they spent, like, a huge number of, like, computer CPU hours rendering these things. Kind of, they came up with some breakthroughs to go beyond standard ray tracing where you, like, trace the path of a photon. And you get these, like, you know, one of the predictions of general relativity is you can get like multiple images of something. So if you have a star behind a black hole or behind, you know, another star, you can get multiple copies of that. You'll see like four or five of those stars, just the way the light gets bent and all that.
I am so confused right now.
Yeah, let's... Yeah. That's a different thing. If you want to see it, just, you know, it's in Interstellar.
This is what I love about podcasting with physicists too, because physics is such an interesting field, because I think of it as having like three iterations. There's a very visual iteration, especially in something like cosmology, where you can kind of point to something and you can say, this is why it looks like that. And then there's a very, I guess I could say, verbal iteration, where you can talk about, oh, but the light bends around it and this is why. And then there's a mathematical iteration that's the part that the layperson, regardless, is never going to understand, simply because it's the same thing as if we were like Korean and we were doing this podcast in Korean and all my listeners didn't speak Korean and they were like, I have no fucking idea what you're talking about. It's a math is so a language. It's a language to describe things, and we don't speak your math.
Yep.
So we have to deal with either the visual or the kind of verbal. And since we're doing a podcast, we can't fucking do the visual. So we're flailing our arms around going, ooh, it bends around this way and it stretches. And nobody can fucking see what we're doing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and a lot is lost in translation when you try to go from the math to the other stuff. I'll do another quick aside, because I think people will maybe find this interesting. Like, when I first started thinking about these black hole things, like the firewall paradox 2 years ago, I had an idea, and it took me probably 3 months to translate that idea into math, and then like another 2 months to do the calculation. And it turns out my intuition was just completely wrong. And so it was like 5 months of, you know, to learn that I was totally wrong.
Could have been 15 years, man.
It could have been 15 years. But the point is, like, when you try to take the way your brain thinks about one of these things, and then, like, you just have no idea. These things are really counterintuitive.
Oh,
and
clearly,
until you actually do the calculations.
My go-to question used to be when I would interview physicists for Talk Nerdy, or for Talk Nerdy to Me, my web series that was on HuffPost for a long time. At the end of my interview with the physicist, I would always ask them the same thing, which was, we always hear about four dimensions. We hear about the fourth dimension, you know, or multiple dimensions. Let's just say that. We hear about multiple dimensions. Can your brain see in that many dimensions? Are you in some sort of fucking special club that I'm not into? And it was really great to hear their different answers, because most people would be like, no. Like, nobody can imagine that, but because we have the math by our side, it helps us. Like, you know, we see a picture of a black hole, for example, in a textbook, and it's two dimensions going into three. That's how we visualize it. But three dimensions going into four, or, like, it starts to get confusing. The only person who didn't answer that way was Neil deGrasse Tyson. He was like, fuck you, of course I can. You're never going to be able to. You're never going to join my club. And I was like, great. Thank you.
Well, it's interesting that you say it from him, because I'm not... I talked to him for like 30 minutes one time. I'm not so sure that that's the case.
No, he was totally joking.
Yeah. Got it.
Just, I mean, he did the whole interesting thing about, like, one of the classical ways to envision is that, let's say that one dimension, there's a dot, two dimensions, there's a line. I'm sorry, one dimension, there's a line, two dimensions. Yes, one dimension, there's a dot, two dimensions, there's a line, three dimensions,
no,
you build out a cube.
No, one dimension, there's a line. Two dimensions, there's, you know, like a cube or a square.
A square. Thank you. One dimension, there's a line. Two dimensions, there's a square. Three dimensions, there's a cube. And so obviously going from one to two is easy. Going from two to three is easy. And his whole thing of going from three to four was that, imagine that you're a dude and you are at one end of the line. You need to go to the other end of the line. You're in the square. You step outside of the square. But now you're in a box. The way that you can go from being in the box to being out of the box is for it to be a different time in the day. At some point in time, you weren't in the box. So you jump into that other time and now you're outside of the box. That's you being in that fourth dimension.
Yeah, well, so... Okay, so another sidebar, but this is something that, another thing I'm passionate about, and this is kind of one of the things I did as a kid, is I was really interested in geometry and the physics I do. Yeah. It's like very geometry-based. There are two things. So to think about higher dimensions, you can either use like a crutch, you can use tricks, or you can try to do it directly. You know, it's pretty easy to learn like the tricks and...
That's
the box thing. Yeah. And so thinking about four dimensions, you can just add time. We have good intuition for what it's like to be.
And that's what most of us do when we think about four.
Right.
But once we get to five, we're like, what the fuck?
Here's another like really kind of simple trick, maybe to think about, to go from two dimensions to like things
five?
That, well, to things that can live in like up to four dimensions.
Okay.
It's like those video games where you're flying and if you go through the top of the screen, you come out the bottom.
Yeah.
Or if you fly through the left, you come out
like
the
Pac-Man.
Right. Yeah, like Pac-Man. So if you think of you having like a piece of paper, and this is a hard thing to describe in words, but like if you have a piece of paper and let's say because you go out the left, you come out the right, that's like gluing the piece of paper around. And so now you're left with a cylinder.
Yeah.
And then because
it's like
you
Madeline L'Engle, you remember A Wrinkle in Time?
Yeah.
Very early. It was an ant on a string, and then the two ends of the string would come together.
Right. But so just to finish this, so like if you fly out the top, you come out the bottom. So now you glue the top and the bottom of the cylinder together. And you're left with a donut.
Yes.
And so like when you play Pac-Man, you're actually playing a game on the surface of a donut. But the reason for bringing this up is it's a trick. You know, like, it's really easy. You can envision a square in two dimensions, but then, like, that surface, it's a two-dimensional surface, but it's embedded in, like, in three dimensions.
In a three-dimensional donut.
And you can do a similar trick, say, you're living in a cube. So, like, you're living in a room, and if you go through the front wall, you come out the back, or the left wall, you come out the right, or the top wall, you come out the bottom. You can make complicated three manifolds, they're called. And so you can actually play these tricks. This is like another type of trick. There are tons of tricks. So then one other thing, because this is another thing I'm passionate about. Uh-huh. Really, this is like what I did as a kid.
Uh-huh.
Like run around trying to visualize higher dimensions.
Well, you also played video games professionally as a kid.
I did.
Maybe that contributed
a
little bit.
Professional Counter-Strike as a kid.
Oh, just Counter-Strike.
Just Counter-Strike.
That's the weirdest job ever. We'll talk about
that
in a second.
But so one more thing. So there are people who can visualize higher dimensions directly. So there's a, like I read on Math Overflow, which is like a forum for mathematicians, like just an offhanded comment from a topologist, like a pretty famous topologist. And he said that, you know, he spent his life thinking about higher dimensions, and he estimates he's maybe had about 15 minutes total in that entire career of having direct visualization of higher dimensions. So it's, you know, you spend like tons of time doing all these tricks and figuring out what it may look like.
And doing all the calculations behind it.
To build intuition and all that. And like in his entire life, he estimates that all of that together is like 15-minute movie of like direct viewing of high dimensional
and
stuff.
Also, who knows? He might have been like on NyQuil. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
He might have just
on
been
Tussin.
Seriously, or like having like so tired that I don't know if you've ever done acid. You don't have to tell me if you don't want to, but I've done acid.
I work
before.
With the government.
There you go. So you've never touched anything that's bad for you. I've done acid before, and when you do acid, you have these moments where you see shit that is so profound and opens up your worldview, and then afterward, you're like, "What the fuck was I talking about?" So, and granted, I'm sure this guy wasn't having like an acid trip, but there are definitely times when maybe you feel like you have insight and intuition, but if you can't replicate it later, it's almost difficult for it to even have any sort of persistent meaning. Of course, there's meaning in his math, and there's meaning in his conversations around it. But that, yes, it's fascinating that, I mean, this all just comes back to this conversation about the fact that so much of physics is a mathematical language that doesn't have a direct visualization attached to it. Mm-hmm. And it's, which is why a lot of times I think that lay people are simultaneously fascinated and frustrated by these kinds of conversations, because we're not fully in the club. You know what I mean?
I mean,
you're like,
I don't
I'm working
feel like,
on it. I've been working on it my whole life to be in the club. You
yeah,
know?
And I still don't feel like I'm in the club.
Yeah.
I mean, some days you do, some days you don't.
So we kind of left off talking about that kind of unstoppable force, immovable object, that situation wherein more classical physics, or I guess we could say relativity, actually, and quantum mechanics within the context of a black hole aren't computing. They're just not reconciling. So now, what did 2012 do?
Yeah, so... this is still so new that I don't think like the physics community yet has a good, clear explanation.
But does everybody buy it? Everybody looks at the paper and goes, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
You're right. Okay, that's good to know.
It took a while for everyone to buy it, but I think everyone now really just buys it and realizes that this is a serious problem, and that like a lot of the best physicists in the world have thought about this for 2.5 years or almost 3 years now and made very little progress.
Gotcha. And your one of your major professors, John Preskill, is like a preeminent black hole theorist.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He won, I think, 2 bets with Stephen Hawking about what happens in black holes.
Oh my God, that's like so cool. Like he must feel like such a badass.
I think so. And so something that, like another thing that's just a little bit of an aside, but is also on topic and it's just a good lesson. So John, you know, he has a blog, quantumfrontiers.com, and I write there sometimes too.
Oh, cool. Yeah, you guys check it out. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's a pretty good blog, and we have a pretty good like readership.
How
and all
cool
that.
To have a professor who has a blog too, and who like is like, yeah, grad students write for my blog. That's awesome.
So one of the things he's written like maybe 2 posts about, he calls himself a 2-trick pony. And what he means by that is like he switched fields. He's kind of been at the top of 3 different fields. He started off as a particle physicist, so as you mentioned, the Higgs before. So these people that think about like particle accelerators and what comes out of them and all that. And then he switched to thinking about black holes and became like a preeminent guy at trying to understand black holes. And then in the mid-90s, switched and really was like one of the founding fathers of this quantum information, quantum computation field.
Which is funny because he spoke at a science soiree, and I'm pretty sure we talked the whole time about black holes.
And so the point is that like when he started thinking about black holes, he used a lot of the tricks from high energy physics. And then when he started thinking about quantum information, they kind of later on, he wrote, like in 2007, he wrote a paper with Patrick Hayden where they applied ideas from quantum information to the black hole setting. So they kind of, same thing, like merged these two fields. And it's just this really important seminal work.
Yeah.
And that paved the way for the firewall paradox. So anyways, John has kind of straddled a bunch of different fields, and it's a different style. Everyone has different styles. Some people just go unbelievably deep with one field. You know, John argues that some physicists can get some mileage out of being a master of kind of, you know, two fields and being the bridge. And the firewall paradox, like, so one final thing right here. So you were mentioning earlier, like, what fields are involved, and you said quantum information, and then you kind of brought up, like, astrophysics also thinks about black holes a lot.
Yeah.
But now, so it's really this intersection where you have the people from quantum information, you have like the high energy physicists, they're called, and what they mean by high energy physics is like particle accelerators.
Gotcha.
You're colliding, you know, particles at high energies. So people that were thinking about like particle theory there, and some of them are string theorists. So you have like the string theorists, the quantum information people, and then also some of the people from general relativity backgrounds are all kind of thinking about this one problem. And it's, I mean, it's the first time this has happened in my life where you have all these different communities thinking about the this one same thing. So it's really exciting. We have these conferences where, you know, like a string theorist will be talking to a quantum information person with like a astrophysicist listening over their shoulder. And it's leading to like really fast progress. And
the funny thing is that historically it would have led to fast progress in any field. In any field, if we hadn't been so obsessed with being the only experts in that field and opening up to other, you see it in my field where I came from in neuroscience. As soon as psychology started to embrace biology, and you saw those things start to have an interplay, and as soon as psychology started to embrace physics and look at computational neurophysiology, and you had that interplay, we learned so much, so much faster. And so I would argue that what John Preskill did in applying all of his knowledge from another field, I mean, it requires superhuman intelligence, which he obviously has, but it also is not just, I don't know, a new kind of personal way to do it, but it's a way that we should all be doing it. I think that we should all at least have a fundamentally well-rounded education at the beginning. So, and I think that we should be required to learn things outside of our field of reference. Like if I'm studying neuroscience, I need to take a genetics class. And yep. Even if it's within biology, because you can't just know about physiology without knowing anything about chemistry, for example. Those things are important. And I mean, I know we keep using science as a context here, which might feel a bit esoteric to anybody listening, but it's the same thing. You know, my friend Tegan, I've mentioned her now a couple times on the podcast, and listen to her episode. She's brilliant. She helps me understand what economics really means. She does the same thing. She takes this very economical approach to thought and applies it to what's happening in the brain. And this is the future of progress, I think, is people from different fields contributing. And so speaking of that, because we're running so late, you have taken this beautiful and intensive background in physics, math, and computer science, and you have kind of amalgamated that into some entrepreneurial prospects.
Yep, that's correct.
And so I don't know how much you're allowed to talk about, but I would love to hear about what is this great thing that's so exciting that is potentially making you think about taking a leave of absence from your physics work? Because you're obviously very passionate about the work you're doing in physics.
Yeah, well, so timing is really tricky in life. And honestly, like what I'm the most passionate about kind of ever has been physics. And I'm just exceptionally passionate about like this firewall paradox. It's pretty cool. And I think it is going to lead to a revolution in physics. But on the other hand, sometimes, you know, you can have two once-in-a-lifetime opportunities happening at the same time. And that's what's happening for me right now. And basically the backstory is I got recruited for a DARPA project in 2010, and I worked on it for a year and a half, and it was a pretty amazing thing and an amazing experience. And, you know, I mentioned, like, that involved deploying to Afghanistan and, you know, really seeing the way bureaucracy works.
Seeing the inside, the ins and outs of the U.S. government, but also seeing, as a civilian, seeing things that a lot of people don't see unless they are enlisted.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is like the standard. This is like time for the plug, just that, you know, could not have more respect for enlisted folks and people in the armed services. It's hard to even describe until you've seen them in action, you know, how much dedication that takes and, you know, how tough of a job that is. And like for me, I was there as a civilian, so you can go home if you need to, and you're getting paid way better, and it's a very different thing. But so anyways, kind of at the end of that, there was an opportunity. Some friends and I started a company, applied for a DARPA program and won a large contract, and kind of used that to bootstrap the growth of a company and won quite a few other contracts after that. Mm-hmm. And so now we're, you know, it's a company that, so I started on a previous leave of absence, and the company kind of really took off, and we're still in stealth mode, even though it's a profitable company with, you know, like 28 people.
So when you say you're in stealth mode, it means like there's no website. You're not going to talk about what your company does because that could have like security implications.
So it's not the security implications. I mean, that was a little bit of it getting started
early on.
Maybe like the first project. Now that's a little bit of it, but it's also that once you open the PR Pandora's box, it requires a lot of bandwidth and management from,
and you, your know, company's like, not built up that big yet. Like, you have employees, you have a fair amount of employees, but you're focused just on doing the work that you do and doing it well.
Yeah, we like right now we have as much work as we can do.
Gotcha.
And we have like the people we need. So, you know, the way I look at it as an entrepreneur, there may be three reasons why you would seek PR. And one of them is like if you want to do fundraising, and others if you want to find
customers.
New employees, and another is if you want to find customers.
Yeah.
And kind of right now, we don't need any of those things.
Gotcha.
And you maybe have like one really good opportunity with the PR. And so there'll be some point in the next few months when the timing's right for us, but
must
we're not
a,
quite
must
there
be a
yet.
Nice position to be in.
You got lucky.
Comfy, I mean, cozy. But now it's making you decide, you know, have to decide what you want to do. You know, you're also in a nice position because you're, you know, a Caltech graduate student, which is not the easiest position to be in either. Like, a lot of people apply for these seats and a lot of people don't get in. And it's kind of the end all be all. You know, you went to, where did you get one of your master's?
My master's degrees are from Stanford.
Yeah, so you went to Stanford for your master's and then you moved on to Caltech.
Yeah.
So you've been in very competitive programs and in programs that a lot of people work hard to get into. So that's a tough position to be in. Like, do I focus 100% of my time on this company that's profitable and growing? Do I focus 100% of my time in this? And you know, it's like we only have so much time.
Yeah, that's absolutely the problem.
And something's got to give. Like, I think that we like to think that that's not the case, but something always has to give. And probably right now you're shirking on something.
Oh, I have a strategy. I haven't yet told everyone my strategy, but it's very clear to me. Actually, just like recently. But yeah, something needs to give.
Yeah.
And it's kind of crazy. I got really lucky and literally got sucked into two revolutions that are like, I don't know, I consider cybersecurity and then this segment of physics that I'm in to be maybe like two of the biggest intellectual revolutions that are happening right now. And, you know, some of the others are like what we can do with the genome. And
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's a handful, and like mapping the entire functionality of the brain, like the big brain initiative.
Exactly.
Like, there's a handful
of things happening in neuroscience and maybe like some of the things happening in behavioral economics and some of the things in big data. You know, they're like at any given time, they're call it like 10 things that are really on fire. And I stumbled into two And you can't really do both at the same time.
And cybersecurity is a fascinating field. I mean, it's a field I don't understand at all, but it's definitely something that politically I'm really passionate about. And it's something that, like, I've probably recommended a million times by now on the podcast that if you haven't seen Colin Hoback's documentary, Terms and Conditions May Apply, you have to watch it. It's so well done. It just reminds you of how much of your personal information you're giving up just to engage in transactions for convenience. And how much, you know, it's like that we're always walking that balance of like, but I like the convenience, but also now you own me and you're selling my interests and my preferences to other big companies. And what does that mean for my agency? You know, it's a very tough line to walk living in a modern culture where we are all connected, both kind of intangibly, but also very tangibly connected.
I mean, we could all just put on tinfoil hats and run to the woods.
We could.
That doesn't.
We could wear.
That's not what I want to do.
We could wear metal blankets like the character in Better Call Saul. If you're not watching it, you should watch it. It's really good. So on that note, I want to ask you, we didn't get to certain things, but I don't care because that I always say this at the end. I'm like, fuck it. That means you have to come back. So we'll just do it again later.
I'm willing to do that.
Perfect. So I close every podcast with the same two questions. And I'm always really excited, excuse me, to hear the differences between people's answers. So the first question is sort of the bummer question, which is when you're looking towards the future, what is the thing that is most kind of worrisome to you? What keeps you up the most at night? And the second is the flip side of that. What are you most excited about? What keeps you optimistic?
Well, the honest answer for me, which is, I don't think what you're getting at, is like the last few months, mm-hmm. being one of the people running this company, mm-hmm. you know, just the interpersonal things are so challenging.
Gotcha. So this is kind of like, is this like your first foray into like real management?
I'd say this is my third, but this is like
the biggest.
This is the biggest with the biggest opportunity and moving the fastest.
I think a lot of people don't realize that, like, when you're the boss or when you're close to being the boss, it's like half and half. The work that you do, half of it is the actual work you're trying to do, the computer program, whatever it is. And half of it is just like making people not kill each other. It's, exactly. It's managing.
Yeah, exactly. It really is like having a pulse on everyone and mm-hmm. trying to make sure that they're having a fulfilling time and like contributing and not taking advantage of you or other people.
And you're not taking advantage of them.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's only scratching the surface. And then like someone didn't eat breakfast and then they like are in a bad mood and they make a grouchy comment and then someone like goes and cries in a corner and you need to then like figure out, should I talk to them? Should I have like their friend talk to them? Should we ignore them?
And also, like, what's appropriate? Like, HR, tell me what to do. I don't know what I'm allowed to do. I'm still
talk
learning.
To the lawyers first.
Exactly. So, okay. I mean, that's, I think, a totally reasonable and fair thing. And I would say in that same context, what are you excited about?
Well, I mean, what am I excited about? So I'm going to say two things. So one is, I mean, I'm really excited about the prospects of this company. I'm mm-hmm. also really excited about this revolution that's happening in physics because of the firewall paradox. Like, as I said before, progress through paradox. And kind of there's this consensus right now. And whenever there's consensus, oftentimes people are wrong. But there's kind of consensus amongst the physicists that we're going to have a big revolution in just the next few years. And kind of I'm biased being in a quantum information group, but we think the revolution is understanding the importance of information in physics. Mm-hmm. And so there's some precedents in the past, but like actually thinking of information and the salient features of it, which is mainly something called entanglement, mm-hmm. those things is like a resource and is a fundamental like entity and building block inside physics, which that wasn't the case in the past. In the past, people in physics cared about like energy of a system and entropy and some of those other quantities. But now like information is really at the center of that. And then I guess the other thing, I'm pretty concerned about global warming,
mm-hmm.
driving in like LA, it didn't rain at all.
Ever.
And especially this winter and also because the economy's really good. Mm-hmm. So people are like out, they don't need to work. They've got money in the bank. The traffic right now is crazy. It's already hot and it's March. it's going to be a pretty warm summer with a lot of people driving. It's going to be pretty crazy. We're going to have a lot of smog. But the flip side of that, what am I excited about?
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of a techno optimist, and I think that once like there's enough pain in something, you know, like as horrible as this is, say enough natural disasters, then resources get allocated and incentives become great enough that, you know, people will actually fund scientists, or there's actually a market opportunity to come up with some solution.
It's true. And we're starting to see it happen. I think the sad thing is that we are just fundamentally lacking as a society, lacking. And maybe I shouldn't even say that, because I don't think that's true. I think the voting public is not what's responsible here. I think it's specific politicians with specific agendas. But that there are so many people that have been ahead of this curve and said, I don't want to wait until we're in pain. We're starting to feel the pain now. We should be doing something. And there's still resistance. So, yes, I do think that we're going to start to see a big change and a big shift. I worry if it's going to be too late.
Yep.
You know? And it's like, it's already too late for certain people. Like, go to fucking Bangladesh exactly. and tell me people aren't in pain. You know? No, when, like, your whole city's underwater.
Yeah, it's exactly right.
It's tough. And so it's like, you do your part. You try to do your part. But that's also tough. Like, you drive a Prius. I have a little electric car. But I ate fucking a shitload of meat for brunch today. So it's like, I'm balancing, too. I'm trying to figure out the places where I can make a change. You know, I'm drinking water from my Brita pitcher. It's not in a plastic bottle. It's like, okay, that's something I can do. But fuck. You know, I still ate like a pulled pork sandwich earlier. Like, I don't think that's very good for the environment. So we work at it. You know, we try to be honest with ourselves and we work at it. But I would love to see bigger policy initiatives. I would love to see bigger regulations and bigger kind of governmental influence saying, and I know that fucking pisses off all of my like libertarian listeners, but I'm sorry. We tried the thing where we left it up to ourselves and we fucking dropped the ball.
Well, yeah, we live in a system where, you know, like only a few people can kind of have really huge impact in the regulation, and that kind of that changes what the market would do, you know,
completely.
Only just a few people. And so, yeah, I don't think any libertarian would say that we have like a system that would even enable libertarian ideals.
Exactly. But there are still people who fight tooth and nail when they hear that word regulation. They just get so upset. And like, it's just crazy because, I mean, real capitalism fundamentally requires heavy regulation. There's no such thing as a free market. A free market is intrinsic to the market that it be regulated. It's the only way it works. Otherwise, we're talking about a black market. We're talking about like a Silk Road. You know what I mean? Like, capitalism requires regulation. Go back to school if you disagree. All right. That's my fucking soapbox. I apologize. I don't know why. I got really angry just then. Not at you.
No.
Thinking about some of the bullshit comments I see on YouTube, and I got mad.
I'm trying to think of like what name you would give that attack you just made, which is like, if you don't agree with me, go back to school. You know, for example, like ad hominem is the style of attack you use if you're losing an argument. Like,
yeah.
I'm losing an intellectual argument, so I'm going to like, you know, just
be mean to you. That's what an ad hominem attack is.
Or, you know, like, yeah, so we're not even having an argument, but that is a powerful thing. Just tell someone to go back to school. I guess it's an ad hominem attack.
Great, great. So now we're closing the episode with you telling me I'm a fucking dick. That's so perfect.
Well, I'm going to be a hipster. You totally outed me that I drive a Prius and about topological, you know, like phases as hipster, like physics. And I'm literally going to Silver Lake after this to walk the Silver Lake Reservoir. So,
okay. So you go have your hipster Saturday
and I will have asshole.
I'll go road rage on some people, as I'm driving around LA. And in the meantime though, I know that like your company is still in stealth mode, so there's not really a website you can point people to yet, but I definitely, you know, maybe is there a place where people can follow you on Twitter or where they can see some of the cool research that's happening in your lab?
Yeah, for sure. So I write on this blog, quantumfrontiers.com, and my name is Sean McGuire. It's kind of a strange spelling, long story. S-H-A-U-N, and then McGuire is M-A-G-U-I-R-E. So you can see me on that blog, or my Twitter handle is Sean M, as in McBride, my mom's maiden name, McGuire. So, yeah.
So it's like Sean McGuire.
I should have put that together earlier, but nope, first time. Yep.
Perfect. Perfect. I love it. All right, guys. Well, hit up Sean and look at the cool stuff that is happening kind of in the world of quantum information. Thank you, Sean, so much for sitting down with me. It was a blast. We're going to have to do it again because there's so much more we could get into.
I'm in. We'll talk about holography next time.
Awesome. I can't wait. And everybody who tuned in, again, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm looking forward to the next time that we get together to talk nerdy.